And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very happy to be welcoming back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, who is someone whose work I'm sure is well known to you, not only for the frequent visits he pays to the morning show, but for his well-written columns that appear in newspapers across the country, including our own Kenosha News, author of After the Cold War. And today we will be focusing on several of his most recent columns and some of the interesting topics that they explore, including the continuing turbulence in the Middle East, ratcheted up by Iran's recent attack on Israel. We'll be remembering the bridge disaster in Baltimore that seems like a long, long time ago, but it was roughly a month ago that disaster occurred. And of course, it brings right to the forefront something that should always be at the forefront, the well-being of our nation's infrastructure. And it may be hard to believe, but 2024 marks the 50th anniversary of the end of the presidency of Richard Nixon. And Dr. Sear has written a very interesting column about Nixon and what at least this headline calls his complicated legacy. And we'll spend a few minutes touching on that and more. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad the weather is not only are you usually and always sunny, but the weather's pretty good, too.
Yes, especially this morning.
Outside the studio.
Yeah, we do have rain on the way this afternoon, but we'll update people on that a little later. But glad.
Thank you for the heads up.
Your column that has, I think, not maybe appeared yet in the Kenosha News, but is about to, is a really interesting column about a continent that, as you, I think, rightly point out, Americans historically have been very absent-minded about, namely the continent of Africa. And you pointed out a recent incident that I knew absolutely nothing about. I was completely unaware of what had occurred in the nation of Niger. And this is probably a combination of our general inattentiveness to the continent of Africa and to major media's inattentiveness as well, caught up in other headline-generating stories. Explain to our listeners what recently occurred there, the what you call unceremonious eviction of America from this country of Niger.
Yes, we have military installations, operations, mostly special operations, special forces, and that kind of thing, pretty much throughout Africa at this point. Niger, there was just a meeting between, a rather unpleasant one, between the Prime Minister, Ali Lamine Zayn, and Deputy Secretary of State, Kirk Campbell, and the leadership in Niger made it very clear, bluntly, they want all 1,000 U.S. military personnel out of their country, OUT, mm-hmm. and we will be out post-haste. It was not the U.S., quite rightly, was very diplomatic in regards to this, but it's part of a more general trend of the growth of fundamentalism, especially of the Islamic variety, and very aggressive efforts by Russia as well as China to expand their influence in Africa, which is nothing new. That was a battleground during the Cold War. Mm. And I think there may well be some advantages to us not being so heavily involved in that continent and various countries there. But there is no doubt that there is instability in Africa.
You pointed out in your column, I was sort of staggered at the list that you included of countries in the heart of Africa that have undergone military coups in Gabon and Mali and Chad and Guinea and several other nations, you call it collectively a worrisome trend.
Yeah.
And indeed, you know, any region of the world where that kind of turbulence is at play, of course, is it's unsettling, and as you point out, it's the kind of situation where stakeholders such as Russia, for instance, can probably take advantage.
Yes, indeed. No, they're speaking of Niger, the last July the government was overthrown. In August of 2020, Mali experienced a military takeover, and coups have also taken place in recent years in Burkina Faso, Chad, and Guinea, countries that tend to be part of the Francophone areas of the world where France has had a long colonial history. And the French military has operated extremely effectively. Not too long ago, I had the opportunity to be sitting at the same table with a very senior corporate leader whom I respect a lot, who has direct military experience, increasingly rare in our business world. And he made a very sarcastic reference to the fact that the French, who can remember when the French last won a battle? Actually, their special operations forces are extremely effective. The French Foreign Legion is not just a Hollywood stereotype, but for several hundred years, a very effective military organization. And we're fortunate that we have them with us in these parts of the world.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one intriguing point you made in this column, in talking about certain dramatic events, including the terrible situation that occurred in Somalia some years ago,
yes.
In which we saw some loss of life and so on. But
in the 1990s,
right.
It's important to note.
Right. But you kind of are talking collectively about some of what is going on there, and in this whole matter of particularly of having positive influence and so on, in your words, it confirms the importance of special operations. I think most of us have only the haziest notion of what is meant by special operations, and particularly what that means in a place like Africa, and, for instance, in a country like Niger.
Unconventional warfare, as opposed to conventional military organization and conventional warfare, World War II and the Korean War, and a substantial part of the Vietnam War. Special operations forces, bluntly, include activities such as targeted killing, trying to win over the local population by using non-lethal means, non-military means, if you will. President Eisenhower was very much in favor of unconventional operations. The U.S. was involved in, notably our Central Intelligence Agency, was involved in overthrowing a variety of governments in the world during the height of the Cold War. We were almost certainly involved in the assassination of one African leader in the very tumultuous area of the Congo, and the breakaway Katanga province in 1960. The Democratic majority in Congress asked Eisenhower after he left office to please provide Congress with, meaning them, with files of his correspondence and all the confidential operations that had been undertaken. And Ike responded, go to hell. He was a strong advocate of executive privilege, which is now a common phrase but wasn't back in the 1950s. He was also insistent that we use capable men but in civilian clothes for special operations that were carried out. The Green Berets, the Army Special Forces, were in the Republican platform of 1952 as part of the effort to the advocacy of liberating Eastern Europe from communism, a crazy idea now and then and in between. But that had strong support during the anti-communist intensity of the early 50s. Eisenhower campaigned on that platform. The Green Berets were put together, and he immediately put them in a drawer and locked the drawer and put chains around the desk and sank it in the water. John F. Kennedy, and especially his brother Robert, who became the Attorney General of the United States, were fascinated by unconventional warfare. He was elected in 1960, barely, with the theme of doing more and being more obviously aggressive in the world against communism. There was important public concern that we had been not aggressive enough during the Eisenhower years. And Kennedy gave emphasis to Greenbury operations and created the Navy SEALs, which are much in the news today, including in areas like Afghanistan, far removed from the oceans and large bodies of water.
Right.
So that's more than you need to know. But one of the positive legacies of the Vietnam War, I believe there are others, is that special operations suddenly became respectable.
Hmm.
Eisenhower's emphasis on a very conventional army publicly was greatly reinforced by Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and Johnson, who had a vision, misguided in my view, that we should make the military much more like a modern corporation, in effect. And that has wisely been since abandoned. But for people interested in military careers, men and women today, special operations troops, you can reach top rank, which was not the case in Vietnam. You were exiled to be a maximum of colonel at the end of your career. That's where your career would end. But now you find top commanders who have had special operations experience. So, sorry for the long lecture, but it's very important. It's almost never discussed seriously in the media or even in policy circles.
Right, absolutely.
So I hope this is informative. I believe it's important. We're talking about life and death.
Absolutely, absolutely. For those of you just joining us, we're joined today with our most frequent morning show guest, Dr.
Wow.
Art Sear. Yes.
Thank you.
Hold that distinction by quite a margin, actually. And
glad I haven't worn out my welcome. Right. Sorry for the interruption. But
far from it.
I have elsewhere, right. I can assure you.
Yeah. No, glad to have you here, as always. So let's talk about a different kind of turbulence, and maybe in some respects, maybe a more positive kind of turbulence, and that is in the nation of Turkey. You wrote recently about a recent election there, which seems to signal kind of a maybe changing political tide in Turkey, and maybe signals increasing difficulties for Turkey's president. Tell us more about what happened in this recent election, and in particular, what it means for us.
Well, Turkey is a close ally of the United States, and I believe, at least so far, that's true whoever is in charge. That seems to be a minority view nowadays, but that's fine with me. Erdogan, the longtime autocratic leader, he's head of a religious party, which under the Constitution is supposed to be banned from power, but since for a little over 20 years, his party has been in power. And he shifted positions. He was, I think president, then he was prime minister, then president, then he shifted back as a way of holding on to power and sidestepping term limits. He's autocratic and dictatorial, but like a very unattractive man in just about every way. But like I say, Turkey is an important ally of ours. And like other autocrats, he has had to respect public representation, the tradition and requirement for elections, which dictators used to be able to cavalierly ignore. But in Venezuela, in Russia, corrupt as the system is, and various other countries, with the single exception of North Korea, even the Vietnamese are having some competition in their elections. You do have to go through the motions. And an opposition has been growing to him over the long term. So in local elections, to answer your question, a couple of weeks ago, opposition parties did extremely well. They've been more and more coalescing because he's in power so long and he's become such a tiresome leader. Women, of an unprecedented number of municipal officials that were elected are women, out beyond Erdogan's party. And the election of women to political office is one of the really great positive trends that also is worldwide. So this is positive for us. But strategically, Turkey is an extremely vital ally. extraordinarily effective militarily, as they proved in Korea and the first Gulf War and elsewhere, geographically in a pivotal position, as lots of people point out. So that's my opinion. You'll find lots of people who don't agree with that, I can assure you.
I especially appreciated a certain turn of phrase, as you're kind of pointing out various facets of modern Turkey, when you say Turkey represents a unique marriage of firmly rooted Muslim religious and cultural attitudes with Western-style governmental and commercial institutions and practices.
Yes.
And apparently this goes back actually quite a long way in Turkey, but the way it's manifesting itself right now is especially interesting.
It goes back specifically a century. A man by the name of Ataturk, an extraordinary revolutionary leader who was just phenomenally intelligent, very tough, physically very tough. He never seemed to sleep. He had just great energy. Literally, they overthrew the very complacent, corpulent sultan in a violent but rational revolution, and he put in place secular institutions. The army is supposed to take over whenever a religious party is approaching power in Turkey, and that happened in 1960, and a number of cabinet members, including the prime minister, were executed by the generals. Happened again in 1980, I believe, but they held back when Erdogan was elected, and I think that's progress. He has since greatly weakened the military in terms of political influence, and that may be a good thing. Military coups are not the way to go through life if you're going to have decent and legal government. Ataturk put all this in place, just a phenomenal leader. Historically, Germany and Turkey are very close. I had the privilege of going to Turkey in 1999, and it's fascinating. It's a combination of the Bible and the Quran and Hollywood. It's very Western fashions. Women are dressed notably in very Western styles. Very cosmopolitan country, one that's developing economically, even though Erdogan has really messed up the economy. But there was a sense of energy that you don't find elsewhere in the Middle East, and they're extraordinarily pro-American, whatever might be in the headlines. The average person on the street is very pro-American, and I don't believe that's changed in the last quarter century.
Right. And, of course, just where Turkey is positioned on the globe makes it such a critical player in a lot of different ways.
Well, they control the Bosporus, which in turn provides access to the Black Sea and between that important body of water and the Mediterranean. That's one of the few seaborne international ports for international access for the Russians, historically a crucial worry of theirs. They're geographically, literally between East and West. They were allied with Germany in the First War, but in the Second World War, they were smart enough to stay neutral and then came in on the Allied side in the last year. The Korean War, they sent a lot of troops to Korea, which was a UN exercise led by the Truman administration and the U.S. The North Koreans avoided the Turks, just like the North Vietnamese avoided the South Koreans during the Korean War. The Turks used to use body parts from the bodies of the enemy to decorate their wire in their location, so you could easily see where the Turks were based. And the other side, the Chinese and the North Koreans, I can assure you, stayed away from them.
A formidable foe.
Very formidable, yeah. And they are on our side. They had senior command positions in Afghanistan, for example, which the media never mentions, and performed very, very effectively in that very vexing conflict. They were close allies of ours in the first Gulf War. A very admirable, very positive leader named Turgut Özal, a very good friend of George H.W. Bush, and a liberal reformer, our kind of guy. He permitted the basing of B-52 bombers in Turkey, which was crucial to the Allied effort in that war.
In another recent column, you talk about Iran's recent attack on Israel.
Yes.
As, of course, that ongoing conflict continues. One of the things you point out that I think would be good to hear more about is the fact that this attack by Iran, in a sense, was, in your words, a very clear break from the recent past. That is, this was not the way Iran has typically responded to potential provocation. Tell us more about how this marked kind of a different Iran and what we should make of that and how we should proceed from here.
Well, it was a change, but it wasn't. The slippery guys in Iran, who have been running the show since 1979, they like to work through proxies, including Hamas and also Hezbollah. Hezbollah fought the Israeli army to a standstill virtually in 2006. So these proxies are not to be underestimated. And Hamas, of course, launched the terrible atrocity against Israel on October 7th. The Iranians launched several hundred missiles against Israel. Israel, as I understand what happened, and a lot of it is still classified, Israel, the U.S., and the British, they were ready for this, and anti-missile systems deployed over Israel, which they call the Iron Dome, managed to minimize casualties to almost nil. It was just a phenomenal success story. The Iranians launched all those missiles, I believe, simultaneously. They were trying to make a gesture more than a lethal attack. They were trying to make a point, probably for domestic political reasons and also regional influence. I don't minimize the importance of this direct attack, but it could have been handled differently if they wanted to kill more people. And Israel responded in a very restrained way, all of which is a good sign. So far the conflict is manageable. President Biden, it's an election year. Even the President of the United States, when a candidate gets kicked around, and Sleepy Joe gets a lot of attacks for being an older gentleman, which since I'm one myself, I take note of that. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is a traditional diplomat and a very effective one. And he stays out of the news, unlike some secretaries of state. And he has been remarkably effective at restraining the Israelis. It looks like there may be another ceasefire, I sure hope so, in the exchange of prisoners. The Bush administration, the Biden administration deserves tremendous credit for keeping things as peaceful as they have been. And especially because Israel is always a challenging ally. Honestly, but with Netanyahu facing, and I believe his wife also facing serious criminal charges, he has a real interest in keeping this war going. And it's just, you really need a lot of Excedrin if you're going to be dealing with this part of the world. And I think Secretary Blinken really deserves tremendous credit for what's happened. So it's bad, but it's not that bad. Could be worse.
Could be worse.
Could be worse, as the Jewish mother says. Could be worse,
the
young man.
One of the things that, of course, has been interesting to see is the widespread protests on college and university campuses across the country, and more than 1,000 arrests and protests quite significant that have occurred at places like Columbia University, UCLA, Dartmouth, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and so on. I'm just curious if you were at all surprised or otherwise have anything to say about the protests that we've been seeing in terms of pro-Palestinian, pro-Israeli students clashing and so on.
It takes me back to the 60s when we had what seemed to be endless demonstrations into the 1970s, and then they faded very quickly, which is important to keep in mind. And I think, and I certainly hope this probably will too, the Middle East Studies Association has been captured by the left, speaking of the 60s and the rise of the left academia and in parts of the media, I might add, on NPR, that has been continuous. And friends of mine who were very distinguished Jewish academics, more than one has complained about the fact that in recent years, Middle Eastern studies has become more ideological and more Islamist. And I think we may be seeing a reflection of that and paying the price for that. It's certainly worth researching if you're an interested citizen. Yeah. And that's one reason these demonstrations are taking place.
Right.
Keep in mind, it was a Palestinian terrorist organization that launched this current problem in the Middle East.
Hamas, yeah.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us.
Since it's so important, I do think the Israeli government has overreacted, says the armchair professor here. But I think they're playing into the hands of Hamas, by the way they've handled the reaction to the attacks. But the left ideology of many American academics is reflected in what's going on in college campuses.
Right.
Especially in this field.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear today. Let's turn our attention to something else on the domestic front. And I really appreciated reading your column about the bridge collapse in Baltimore. And, of course, just about all of us have seen that remarkable video footage that captured the moment when that disabled ship, in a sense, crashed into that bridge, sending it tumbling in into the harbor. And, of course, if, as you rightly point out in your column, if that disabled ship had not radioed its plight and the bridge not been emptied of,
cleared,
of traffic,
yeah,
that could have been a far worse disaster than it was. As it is, it was significant enough. And, of course, what you're saying is that it is exactly the kind of incident that undermines the importance of infrastructure, which is all around us, and yet something that far too many of us tend to take for granted. Explain how we are in the situation that we are in terms of the eroding of our infrastructure and the significant moves that have been made to remedy that by the Biden administration.
Well, infrastructure is gigantic. Literally, it is gigantic today, especially in the U.S., the most advanced and most effective, as well as largest economy in the world and richest. To give some credit to NPR, and specifically your colleague Kai Rizdal, who does this business report that I find extremely last night, driving home, I was listening to him and a colleague, temporary colleague, I guess, in Arizona, talking to people involved in a huge, and I mean huge, chip manufacturing installation that is creating jobs not just for computer types and tech types, but also welders. Well, a main theme of their report was how the ongoing technological revolution is really, renaissance is really greatly strengthening the traditional trades. One of the gentlemen they interviewed was a young man who'd been a teacher, but he found he could make a lot more money if he joined one of his college friends who'd gone into welding. And he was teaching welding, which is always challenging and particularly specialized when you're dealing with these high technology facilities, which I don't presume to understand, but I know they're important. It was really a fascinating report and worth looking up on the web. The all roads seem to lead to Eisenhower, in this case, literally. In the 1950s, there was pressure for an interstate highway system. But in the 1950s, he really made that a priority. Mm. And we now have this integrated nationwide structure that moves literally gigantic amounts of traffic. It helps the average American, the average Joe and Jane. Think of the listeners. Think of how often you hop on and off of the freeway, maybe to go to work or maybe to visit grandma or maybe for other good things. if we had to depend on the old road system, think of what life would be like.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, and he did that.
One thing you mentioned about President Eisenhower, you know, someone, of course, you greatly admire, and for good reason.
Yeah, for a very good reason.
Yeah, in terms of creating, helping to create, at least, this interstate highway system, one of the things you mention is the way in which, in your words, Ike outflanked opposition, especially in rural areas among parochial interests.
Including Republican congressmen he had to get along with and who drove him crazy.
So just explain how President Eisenhower was able to, in a sense, circumvent or surmount that opposition. And particularly, I'm curious to hear more about the opposition from much of rural America, about something that, of course, now is an integral part of rural America.
Anti-communism, national defense, lots of GIs, especially of all ages, had encountered very directly the German Autobahn in the last months of the war. In 1945, as we invaded Germany, it was just a phenomenal system that had permitted them to conduct defensive war in the last year of World War II after D-Day, which is coming up, so remarkably effectively, despite the fact that we had air superiority and they were increasingly heavily outnumbered. It was just a phenomenal highway system. And Eisenhower used this directly as an argument. If the Red Army invades America with a straight face, this system will be essential for our defense. Keep in mind, over half the federal budget in those days was for the military-industrial complex, a term he coined, for defense. And so he was able to divert enormous amounts of defense spending. We had no Department of Transportation. Enormous amounts of federal spending into this interstate highway system for a highway system that was overwhelmingly run by states, except for some very modest federal highways that dated from early in the century. And one of Eisenhower's missions as a young staff officer, I believe, was to go on the convoy from the East Coast to the West Coast that laid out the first of the federal highways on old wagon trails and Indian trails across the country. So he, from an early age, I think we can thank General Pershing, John J. Pershing, one of Ike's mentors, for this initial emphasis on transcontinental transportation. But he devoted huge amounts of defense money to meeting the Red Menace. But actually, it's the highway system that helps us go see grandma or granddaughters or whatever, get along with the boss effectively because we get to work on time.
Well, and, you know, you are so right to point out in your column and in what you're telling us today that because the interstate highway system has been around, I mean, for as long as I've been alive,
yeah,
for nearly as long as you've been alive, that it is so easy to take for granted, and we forget about what that system of highways was once upon a time, in which there was no overarching master plan that made it kind of a cohesive and effective way to travel across the country. I mean,
yes,
it was like the Wild West there for quite a long time. I mean, well into the 20th century.
Yeah, the best kind of leadership has the insight that that is not yet commonplace to see what we need 20 years from now. And the American love affair with the car was undeniable and unavoidable from about the time of General Pershing's effort to send that military convoy across the country. In the 1920s, we were having big traffic jams. Hmm. And look for that in leaders, whether it's a corporation or a small business or a college or a university, the man or woman who can see and sensibly see and make a case for what other people don't see yet. Right. Eisenhower had this to a phenomenal degree. He would astound people from a young age by his ability to point out human dimensions or physical dimensions that were clearly important once he pointed them out.
Sure.
He was phenomenal at reading people.
Mm. I wanted to, I know often in your columns, quite often you will recommend a book that people seek out for more information. I want to just mention a book because I interviewed the author. This is several years ago, an author by the name of Earl Swift, and his book, The Big Roads, The Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers who created the interstate highway system. And it's a very, very good book that kind of tells the long story. And even ahead of President Eisenhower, under whom, you know, efforts really culminated and finally were implemented. But this book tells kind of the long story of how all of that ultimately came into being. So anyway, but The Big Roads, a really, really good book on
Earl
topic.
Swift.
Yeah,
good
Earl
to know.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear. In our closing minutes, we're going to be talking about a column that focuses on a 50th anniversary that will be coming up a little later this year, namely the resignation of our, I think he was the 37th president, if I remember, was he? Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon.
Uh-huh.
And in your column about President Nixon, at least the headline in the Kenosha News, as your column appeared, made mention of Nixon's complicated legacy.
Yes.
And that indeed is part of what you explore. Tell us about the complicated story of Mr. Nixon and kind of that intriguing mix of success and call it failure that is part of his story.
Well, Eisenhower wanted him as his running mate. Nixon had brilliantly positioned himself. He was a close ally of Senator Joe McCarthy, the demagogue who dominated the scene, rather like Donald Trump in many ways. Very irresponsible, very headline crazy, destroyed a lot of people's careers, including some dedicated Foreign Service officers and professors who were generally innocent of the charges that he laid on them. Nixon actually found a traitor who was a member of the Communist Party, a senior member of the old Eastern upper class, who was very much involved in foreign policy during the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, by the name of Alger Hiss. So, he denied until the day he died that he'd been a Soviet agent, but archives revealed after the Soviet Union collapsed confirmed that Nixon was absolutely right in determining early on that, in fact, real communists and spies did exist, and they were crucial to compromising our security concerning delivering the atomic bomb to the Soviet Union. He was part of that anti-communist movement, but he was also clearly internationalist, emphasized the importance of, he was a bridge between the dominant isolationist wing of the party and the extremely important internationalist wing that tended to nominate presidential candidates. Eisenhower also predicted early on that, I think Dick will probably get to the White House, but I don't think he's capable of finishing two terms, which turned out to be what he said quite privately. But I'm confident that's a direct quote. And he didn't treat Nixon very well while he was in the White House for calculated reasons. Anyway, Nixon, he outfought, outthought, outmaneuvered legions of enemies. He was always controversial. But he ultimately did himself in with his terrible insecurity and anxiety, which seemed to get worse the further he went along. And he had a taping system in the White House that was on all the time. Now, FDR taped White House meetings, and John F. Kennedy did, and Eisenhower almost certainly did, at least at NATO, when he was the commander. But they would have an on and off switch. It was like Nixon was almost willfully creating the evidence. He finally brought himself down. I was around him twice. This might be interesting. When I was quite young, I worked at a supermarket on Saturdays and after school. And one Saturday, when I got to work early, I would get there early to read a book to make sure I had an old 52 Chevy that regularly created engine trouble. So I was reading my book, and suddenly these young cheerleader types showed up, very attractive young ladies in cheerleader outfits with big blue N's on their white uniforms and big ends on the tops of their straw hats. And I was wondering what this was about. And when Nixon was running for governor of California in 62, he came to the supermarket where I worked. So I saw him then,
So these were cheerleaders for
Nixon.
Candidate Nixon. Wow.
Yeah.
With N on the
chest.
Yes. Okay. Wow.
Used to be, I mean, that was part of every big political campaign. Hmm. I think there were Nixonettes.
Okay.
Anyway, he was already losing, and I saw him close up. Almost nobody came to the rally. It was a very informed speech, but he was really, despite my youth and innocence, I could tell this man was really beleaguered, and he didn't seem to enjoy it. And then he spoke to the Economic Club of Chicago. It must have been 1988 or maybe 89. He was able to come back from his forced resignation. And there were 3,000 people at this event. It was so huge that there had to be a second auditorium where his speech was videoed in. I am acquainted with Zha Zhao, who was a very impressive lawyer from China. She was Nixon's interpreter, which means she must be a brilliant linguist in 72. Very, very intelligent person, and she did very well because she came here when China was just opening up in the 80s in a big way and joined Baker and McKenzie, a very important international law firm. And she became active with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, where I worked. So because I knew her, I got myself invited to a private reception. And we had the private reception was still very big. And there was a receiving line. I invited my wife, who was good enough to come with us, since I was going with this woman. So I was there with these two very pleasant ladies. And we went through the receiving line, and when Nixon and Madame Zhao encountered each other, he gave her a big bear hug.
Wow.
It was really quite emotional.
Hmm.
It was an interesting side of Nixon. His speech was almost an hour, and he had no podium. He had a floor mic. He had no notes, and he stood there and delivered one of the most phenomenal tours of the world and foreign policy that I've ever heard.
Wow.
Just incredibly able.
Hmm. Well, and one of the things your column points out is that that his achievements were historic.
Yes.
And that he also surmounted incredible obstacles in many cases to achieve his position and to make these things happen. So, but all these years later, that has receded in significance in our kind of collective memory. What we mostly remember is the disgrace with which his presidency ended in 1974.
I don't know about that, Greg. I think I disagree with you. Actually, the atmosphere I remember it very clearly when he was forced out. That the whole emphasis was on evil Nixon and this terrible criminal. And
true.
But if you're at all serious about foreign policy, the opening to China, the strategic arms limitation treaties, Henry Kissinger was center stage taking all the credit, but actually there's absolutely no doubt he was working for Nixon, and the president was, the opening to China was a strategic coup that's meant our conflict today is actually not nearly as bad as it would have been. And it greatly compensated for the American strategic defeat in Vietnam.
Right.
I believe. So I think we're actually focusing more on what he did, which is what he hoped.
Well, I think serious thinkers are. I guess I'm speaking more on behalf of more casual observers who, you know, much to your consternation, tend to only pay attention to the headlines. But I think you're right. For anybody who thoughtfully considers his legacy, and particularly when it comes to matters of foreign policy, yeah, there's no question his significance. And I think you're also right that a significant reappraisal of Mr. Nixon occurred years after his resignation and even after his death.
Yeah. An appropriate final note, maybe. He would graciously meet with young Republican men and increasingly women who were ambitious to run for office. He really spent an awful lot of time with young people. I don't think it was entirely calculated. It would be, there are a lot of big politicians who wouldn't do that unless it was a photo op. And he was often asked about controversy, not surprisingly, and Nixon invariably responded, "Don't worry about controversy. Controversy can be your friend. Look what controversy did for my career."
Wow.
It was crucial. Worry about being boring. Once the voters lose interest in you, you're finished.
Right.
Don't be boring. Don't worry about being controversial.
Interesting. Wow.
And I think insightful.
Yeah. That is interesting food for thought, very much so. That's a great note on which to finish out what's been yet another really interesting and wide-ranging conversation. I always appreciate every opportunity to sit across the table from you. Dr. Art Sear, appreciate the time you've given us today on The Morning Show and look forward to another visit from you next month.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much.